Good morning, everyone. Thank you again for joining us on our In Conversation With call this morning. We greatly appreciate you signing in and taking your time to join us. And I'm now going to turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Pam, can you hear me? I've been auto-muted for some reason. I had to unmute.
We can hear you. Yes, you're all set.
Terrific. Thank you. I guess one indication that we've been having fewer of these is that the situation regarding COVID-19 is a bit better in New York than it's been. But as we all know, this virus has been raging in other parts of the country. And we do remain at low levels here in the city of New York. But ironically, we are now quarantining people from an increasing number of states outside of the Northeast as people come back into New York. So we remain vigilant and are opening up slowly. This, however, gives us an opportunity now for us to learn more about this virus and the way it works to produce disease, with the hope of informing better surveillance, treatment, and ultimately the development of an effective vaccine. So, still timely that we're having these conversations. Currently, there are almost 200 vaccines in development. There are four of them in phase three clinical trials, which means large numbers of people are getting these vaccines. And in China, there's actually one that's been approved for limited use in the military. We also are continuing therapeutic trials. Some are quite promising. In fact, we've spoken about remdesivir, the antiviral, which has shown some promise in people with acute disease, as well as corticosteroids. There are other therapeutics that are being tested, including convalescent plasma and a number of other inhibitors of this over-exuberant immune response in patients that, again, are still ongoing. It's a little early to tell, but promising as well. Another area that we've been particularly interested in at Montefiore and Einstein is trying to understand who's at greatest risk for disease. And you've heard about the number of factors that are important, including age, the state of your immune system, if you're immunosuppressed, as a result of cancer, or have an organ transplantation, or some other chronic disease, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes. It seems that you are at increased risk of maybe not being infected, but being infected in a way that's more adverse to your health and an increased risk of dying from this infection. So we're really fortunate today to have Dr. Shivani Agarwal with us to talk about the relationship between diabetes and COVID-19 infection. Dr. Agarwal is the director of the Supporting Emerging Adults with Diabetes Program at Montefiore and an assistant professor of medicine at Albert Einstein. And she, like many of our physician scientists, have pivoted in the era of COVID to try and better understand this disease. And in her case, this is through the lens of diabetes, not only as a risk factor, but as a consequence of COVID and as a way and thinking about how best to manage patients with diabetes who get infected with SARS-CoV-2. So let me, without further ado, introduce Dr. Agarwal and have her talk a little bit today about the intersection of diabetes and COVID-2. Shivani, thanks for joining us.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Dean Tomaselli, for that nice introduction, and you set me up perfectly. So I am really excited to be on this call today, and like Dean Tomaselli said, I really have pivoted to try to address diabetes in COVID-19 and these really complex relationships, especially because diabetes really affects a large proportion of our Bronx population and just the, you know, international population of the world. You know, diabetes now affects just under half a billion people in the world. And so this is not a national phenomenon. This is actually an international phenomenon. And we're just starting to crack the puzzle here. So I'm going to talk to you first, just briefly, about some of the data that's already out there about the increased risk of poor outcomes and morbidity and mortality from COVID-19 in patients with diabetes, and then pivot to talk about a little bit more about the work that we've been doing under the Fleischer Institute for Diabetes and Metabolism, of which I am a faculty member in, as well as the larger Montefiore Hospitals umbrella. So what we've found out from many studies, China, Europe, South America, and the US, is that people with diabetes are more likely to have severe COVID-19 disease if they are infected, and they're more likely to have need ICU level care, get mechanical ventilation or intubation, as well as die. And so there are some, again, national studies, international studies showing that the rates of death among people with diabetes are almost 50% more than those compared without diabetes from COVID-19. And so, you know, this kind of, I think, crystallizes a real risk factor and something we need to figure out how to mitigate, whether it's trying to work on helping the diabetes patient in the outpatient setting before they get COVID and get hospitalized. Are there things that we can mitigate in terms of their diabetes treatment or their glucose control that may actually help them help prevent the severity of disease or mortality? Or is it something that we have to do in the inpatient setting in order to help these patients kind of, again, control blood sugars, help us manage them in a way that we can try to prevent these poor outcomes from happening? Now, I should add that in addition to kind of the pulmonary endpoints that we've seen, we're also seeing higher rates in the people with diabetes of a renal injury, of needing renal replacement therapy like hemodialysis. Some are, I think, again, we're still sussing out the outcomes, but some are just in the immediate hospitalization. Others actually convert to needing hemodialysis more long-term or in the subacute period. But we've also found that COVID-19 itself worsens diabetes outcomes. So there's an emerging literature now, and I have definitely seen this with my own eyes at Montefiore, that there's kind of two ways that we're seeing diabetes manifest itself, kind of related to COVID because of the infection, but not related to the pulmonary and other, you know, multi-organ consequences of COVID. So one is that we're starting to learn, and again, across the world, that COVID-19 may actually be implicated in new onset diabetes. So there is some data from the SARS-1 epidemic, you know, almost a decade, more than a decade ago now, that there is some biological mechanisms in the pancreas that actually have the ACE2 receptors on them. So the beta cells in the pancreas are the cells that produce insulin that are help us regulate our blood sugars, and the ACE2 receptor is one of the receptors, the main receptor, which the SARS-CoV-2 virus actually binds to. And so they think that there might actually be a mechanism by which COVID actually infects or influences the way the pancreas works and the insulin production works, such that it may actually cause new onset diabetes. Another thing that we're seeing in our patients with pre-existing diabetes is that they're starting to get what's called a very dreaded complication and an emergency called ketosis or ketoacidosis. And what that is an acid buildup in the blood stream that can be fatal as a consequence of very high blood sugars that haven't been able to be treated appropriately. And we're finding that, you know, this is actually a much more common complication in people with type 1 diabetes with pre-existing type 1. We're finding that COVID-19 has actually brought this out in people with pre-existing type 2 diabetes. And even among those people who are not even on insulin prior, who may have been on either no treatment or one oral medication. So you can imagine that, you know, while we know that people with diabetes have worse COVID-19 outcomes, we also are seeing that they're having worse diabetes outcomes. And those diabetes outcomes are things that we have to mitigate and manage apart from the COVID-19 outcomes. So this group is really, I think, complicated, but we're starting to kind of crack the puzzle a little bit. And so some of the work that we've done at Montefiore is trying to figure out how we can help people with diabetes, both type 1, type 2, or with new onset, in ways that can really prevent some of these poor outcomes. So one of the, I'm gonna just go through some of the initiatives that we have implemented and I have led during the pandemic, and have really, I'm just gonna say to my humble surprise, it has made national, international news. And I think that, you know, Montefiore and Einstein really can lead the way here, and we have been leaders, but with your support, we can continue to be the leaders and lead the way even more. So one of the analyses that we've done with the help of Jill Crandall, Yaron Tomer, who Jill Crandall is the chief of endocrine division. Yaron Tomer is, as many of you might know, is the chair of medicine. William Southern, who's the head of the hospitalist service, and Clyde Schechter, who is a senior statistician and physician in the family and social medicine division. We did an analysis looking at outpatient risk factors for mortality in hospitalized patients with diabetes and coronavirus COVID-19. And we basically were interested in looking at diabetes-specific factors before patients got hospitalized that might actually change the severity and the risk while they were hospitalized with COVID. So what we looked at were things like hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of long-term glucose control. We looked at diabetes treatment regimens, such as whether they were on oral medications or insulin treatment. We looked at some important sociodemographics like age, sex, BMI, and race, and then clinical characteristics such as presence of comorbidities, complications such as cardiovascular disease, hypertension, and chronic kidney disease. So we were really interested in looking at whether these variables and these factors were related to mortality in the hospital from COVID-19. And what we found really was very interesting is that we found that glycemic control, the A1C levels, really had nothing to do with ultimate mortality. And this is what surprised us. We looked at this many different ways because I just could not believe my eyes. But we found this, and now it's actually been confirmed by a French study, a very good French study as well, that it looks like the long-term glycemic control that we tried to improve in our patients really may not be the factor that is implicated in diabetes and the severity of disease for COVID. What we did find was obesity or overweight status, age, sex, and insulin treatment all were very strongly related to mortality. And it's something that we have to think about. You know, we can't modify some of these things, but we may be able to risk stratify these patients when they get to the hospital and give them, maybe preferentially give them some of the treatments that the dean was talking about before to mitigate some of these issues. I will say that this paper has actually now been accepted at Diabetes Care, which is one of the more preeminent journals in diabetes. We're very excited about that. And that was all at Montefiore with all of our Montefiore staff. And I was really lucky enough to be with these senior researchers who really helped guide me in that. So I'm just gonna pivot quickly now to some of the other the interventions that we did. So I'm a person that cannot just stand by and watch. I have to do. And so when I was on the consult services for endocrine and seeing these patients so sick, I really had to do something to help them and the nurses and the staff at the hospital who were really trying their best with, you know, under such duress. So we have two very exciting protocols that we implemented in the hospital. And I'm just going to say, I mean, again, this is a national and international audience that knows about these. I am now in conversations and in research groups kind of flying the Montefiore Einstein flag in ways that I would never have been able to do before. So one of the projects we're doing is the continuous glucose monitoring in the hospital. So just briefly, a CGM device, a continuous glucose monitor, is a small device, probably the size of half of your finger, your index finger, that will go on your arm or another piece of your body and senses your glucose continuously, and it replaces finger sticks. That device can also tell you if you're high or low and predict high or low blood sugars. So it's approved for outpatient use in the clinic, but it's not approved for in the hospital. What we found is we really wanted to monitor glucose values much more closely in these COVID patients with diabetes because their blood sugars are very high. They have a lot of variability. And we also wanted to reduce the need for personal protective equipment and offload the nursing burden. So we actually, with the approval of hospital leadership and the FDA, we used these devices off-label on our patients with diabetes in the hospital and COVID. And it was really transformative. We used them mostly in the ICUs. We replaced hourly finger sticks, so you can just imagine the amount of resources we saved with that. We also were able to catch much more low blood sugars in patients before they got symptoms, so I think we really did manage to improve patient outcomes. It was really transformative, and so now there's a national conversation about how we can make this more uniform even across patients without COVID, and we're part of that national conversation. The other thing that we did was a subcutaneous insulin DKA protocol, which diabetic ketoacidosis, as I mentioned before, is kind of a grave, very dangerous complication of high blood sugars, and you get acid buildup in the blood. The usual treatment for that is an insulin infusion, so an insulin drip, where, again, you need hourly finger stick and very skilled nursing and ICU-level care in most settings, because you're changing the insulin drip, the insulin doses, according to those hourly finger sticks. So we actually developed, based on other protocols, we developed a COVID-19 DKA protocol in which we actually did every four-hour dosing, every four-hour finger sticks. And again, we found similar efficacy of this protocol to the insulin drip while greatly reducing the need for PPE and for nursing. So again, and again, we're part of this national conversation. And right now I'm actually heading up a multi-site trial to evaluate this, the efficacy and safety of this protocol. So we're the lead site, but it's going to be us, MGH, Emory, and University of Colorado. So just to conclude, I think, because I know we don't have a lot of time, diabetes is a major risk factor for morbidity and mortality in COVID-19, and conversely, COVID-19 is a risk factor for worsening diabetes outcomes. And some of the data and some of the exciting initiatives that we've done, you know, are just the tip of the iceberg. And I would really say that we just need to continue to push the limits in what we can provide for our patients, and I'm really excited to do that. I will give kind of a personal thanks to the Fleischer Institute support. They've supported me in my non-COVID work with the Supporting Emerging Adults program, and I will just say, if any of you are interested, please reach out to me, because that is also near and dear to my heart, very important for our young adults with type 1 diabetes transitioning from pediatric to adult care. But they've also really been instrumental in helping us, the Fleischer Institute, really lead the way in terms of this COVID-19 diabetes work. But these projects really require a lot of coordination. So it would really be greatly enhanced by more support, guidance, and anything. You know, I will continue to fly this Montefiore-Einstein flag for these national and international studies as much as I can. So that's all I'll have to say now. Thank you.
Shivani, that's terrific. And congratulations on some true innovation around the management of diabetes in critically ill patients. And I agree, this is going to extend well beyond COVID-19 into other areas where, in fact, we've struggled with managing diabetes well in critically ill patients. And I think you've made some great strides in that direction. So a couple of questions, perhaps. Are the patients who get diabetes in the context of this infection, ultimately people who you think are destined to become diabetic at some point in time in the future? Were they not infected? We know that there's a little bit of a difference in the types of diabetes that these folks get. So would these people otherwise have gotten diabetes, or are they truly subject to this risk and wouldn't ever have been somebody that you would have considered developing diabetes with age?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I'm going to say I'm not sure yet, but I think the reason I'm not sure is we are seeing, because we just need to follow these patients more. What we're seeing in the hospital, which is really interesting with our new onset diabetes, is that we have a blood test to test for type 1 diabetes, these antibody tests, because it's an autoimmune disease. And those blood tests have largely been negative in these patients with new onset diabetes. So I don't think that they have type 1 diabetes. They have some sort of form of type 2. And whether or not it's just a shock to the pancreas and a shock to the system that's going to last, you know, a few weeks or a few months, or this is going to be long term, I think we really have to find that out. And it's a really important question, I think, for all of us, because we wouldn't want to add more to the burden of diabetes we already have.
Yeah, true. And getting back to your passion about young adults with diabetes, do younger people, there may not be enough data here, behave differently with respect to the development of glucose intolerance and diabetes when infected with COVID than older patients?
Yeah, I haven't seen any age-specific. I guess what I have seen more is maybe just an age-related thing as opposed to a diabetes-related phenomenon, but I've had a lot of patients in my young adult practice, which, you know, we have over 150 young adults now in my practice in the SEED program. They have, with COVID, they've seen a lot more diabetes complications than the pulmonary complications or the other complications we see that bring people to the hospital. So interestingly, the people from the SEED program and other young adults with diabetes have gone to the hospital because of glucose issues, not because of COVID issues. They just happen to also have COVID, which is probably underlying these issues. So I think the way, at least as clinicians, we have to think about this is that COVID can manifest in many different ways, and it may be age-related or it may be diabetes-related, but we have to understand the spectrum. From my point of view, because I know that, I did active outreach to my young adult patients to change the way that we provide guidance for them, support them. So I would say, you know, just so you know, if your blood sugars are all of a sudden high and you don't understand why, you may actually have COVID and not realize it. So you have to go get tested. So I think it changed the way I practiced just based on those age differences.
Terrific. And you mentioned that hemoglobin A1C, which is a longer term reflection of glucose control, isn't a great predictor of outcome here. Is there anything else that is in these critically ill patients, pH, levels of ketones, or other biomarkers that might say, hey, we really need to kind of get on top of this person or they're not going to do well?
Yeah, so that's a great question. That's my question too. So it's a good segue. We did our kind of outpatient analysis thinking we'd find, you know, this A1C metric, and we didn't. And so now we're actually doing an inpatient analysis. So we're going to look at biomarkers, including glucose, including, you know, COVID, inflammatory indices, the whole gamut of biomarkers you could think of, while the patient's hospitalized, to see if those factors may predict mortality more. So we're actually undergoing it now, and I should have the analysis done in the next 1 or 2 weeks with the same group that did the outpatient analysis. So right now I can't tell you, but I will be able to tell you very soon.
Okay. That's a promissory note that we'll collect on at some point in time.
Okay.
So maybe one last kind of fundamental question. So why is it that this virus produces diabetes? Do you have some speculation here? I mean, some people have claimed that this is mostly a disease that affects the vasculature, and the reason why there's such widespread organ dysfunction is that it's not the organ per se, but it's the blood vessels that supply these organs that are suffering the most from COVID-19. What's your speculation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have a few theories. So, you know, one of them really could be, and I think that the vascular theory is very interesting, that the pancreas is a very delicate organ. And any change in blood flow to that organ, it can get damaged very easily. So the vascular theory that you just proposed may actually be the issue here, that, you know, any changes in vascular flow, these patients have a lot of hypercoagulability. They get a lot of clots in these small blood vessels and the large blood vessels, but mostly small. So if the pancreas doesn't get enough blood flow and gets damaged, then it can't do its job of producing insulin and regulating the blood sugar. So that's definitely one theory. Another theory, and something I'm particularly interested in because I'm a type 1 diabetes specialist, is how the inflammatory milieu of the inflammatory cascade and hyperinflammatory state of COVID may actually mediate or change some of the immune response that we have. And if we have a predisposition to type 1 diabetes already, and then we get COVID-19, maybe it actually triggers an immune response, an immune, you know, autoimmune attack of the pancreas, just like type 1 diabetes would normally happen, but COVID-19 accelerates that process. So that's something I'm really personally interested in. I haven't seen it yet, but I you know, again, to be continued, because we have so much more to study. The other thing I think that is important also is looking at the fact that these patients also have, may have more insulin resistance, and some of the drugs that we give to treat COVID may actually trigger diabetes just or high blood sugars, and then the, you know, innate response to those high blood sugars is they can't overcome that. So, and that may be more of a type 2 diabetes picture. So So I'm sorry I can't pin that down for you, but those are my theories. I think there, and we may have many different paths, you know, there may be multiple types of diabetes that come out of this instead of just one.
Well, that's terrific. And again, we are still in early days yet in trying to figure out how this virus affects people and creates problems for folks. And this was a terrific summary, and I want to thank you, and I thank everybody who's joined the call and your support, because your support really has helped do the things that we're trying to do here at the Montefiore and Einstein, and that is to create new kind of innovative approaches to patients to understand disease. COVID just happens to be the one that we're focused on right now because it's a pandemic, but as Dr. Agarwal mentioned, the Fleischer Center and diabetes is a problem that's not going away when this pandemic goes away, and obviously we are always looking for ways to better care for our patients and understand the nuances of these diseases. So again, I want to thank everybody for joining us today. I want to thank Dr. Agarwal for a great presentation, and I want to wish you all a great weekend, and stay safe, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.